Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
First off, the Germans were prepared to destroy the city. All the bridges over the Seine were wired with bombs to explode. All the city's power plants were wired to explode. And Hitler reportedly kept calling General von Choltitz, who was the commander of forces in Paris, he kept calling and saying, is Paris burning? He wanted to know that Paris was going to be burned to the ground before the Germans pulled out.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the stunning move, the armies of Nazi Germany annihilated the French military and captured Paris, the crown jewel of Europe, in a matter of a few weeks in early 1940. As Adolf Hitler tightened his grip on the fabled City of Lights, the shocked Allies regrouped and began planning for a daring counterattack into Europe. The longer the Nazis held the city, the greater the danger its citizens faced. By 1944, over 120,000 Parisians died, and countless more tortured in the city's Gestapo prisons and sentenced to death camps. The exiled general, Charles de Gaulle, was headquartered in the bar of London's Connaught Hotel and convinced General Dwight Eisenhower to put Paris before Berlin. He told him that unless Paris was taken immediately, the City of Lights would be leveled. And he had good reason for concern because there are many cities throughout Europe that were utterly destroyed and its medieval and historical quarters completely gone to history because of what happened in the battles of World War II. Many feared that the exact same would happen to Paris. Today's guest is Martin Dugger, author of Taking Paris, The Epic Battle for the City of Lights. We discuss the story of the people who set the city free and the account of the battle for the heart and soul of Paris in one of the 20th century's darkest moments. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Martin Dugger. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Your book made me consider something that's a fairly well-known topic, the taking of Paris in World War II. But I lived in Central Europe for a number of years, and I viewed a lot of cities that were completely destroyed by the war. And you could tell because they had very new architecture compared to the next city over that still had its medieval town center that wasn't. And I never thought of Paris as being under threat. So this should be a lot of interesting things to unpack. But in order to enter into the subject of your book, there's a theme that's common in military history, but also political history as well. And that's generals always planning and fighting the last war. And this is something that France is definitely guilty of in the preparation for World War II. So to begin the examining the topic of the taking of Paris in World War II, what were the factors of the generals planning and fighting the last war that caused it to be taken so quickly?
There are a number of things, and you bring up a good point. You think about the Maginot Line, which the French famously set up as a series of defenses to prevent the Germans from coming in. And what the big difference between World War I and World War II is not just the use of armor and the tank, but the effective use of it in a very fast, you know, we call it the blitzkrieg, but just a nonstop advance where the infantry has to keep up. And when you have infantry moving and you have tanks moving, you're not going to fall into trench warfare. Static defenses don't work anymore. It's worth noting that in May 1940, when the Germans invaded France in this massive blitzkrieg, the U.S. was holding war games in Louisiana at the time, and we were a nation that depended much more on horse cavalry than on armor. And they actually had much more influence over the policies and strategies of wartime America. And it's almost laughable to think about it, but there was a time when there was a tipping point, like, do we stay a horse country? Do we become an armor country? And it's just, to me, it's ludicrous, but it's still, that's people living not just in the last war, but in a war of 70 years ago.
Yeah, it's very hard for vested interests to be dislodged. The military is a bureaucracy like any other bureaucracy. And who knows, maybe the horse or the cavalry lobby was very strong and it prevented the armored division lobby from being able to affect strategy that way.
Actually, that was very much the case. It was considered kind of political career suicide to be a tank guy. And you know, when Patton was a tank commander in World War One, and at the end of World War One, when we just demilitarized, his career just flattened out. He was done just because he was a tank guy, and we got all the way away from tanks and back to cavalry.
My field of study was the Ottoman Empire, and there's a phrase that still exists in Turkish, and that's when board weapons were invented, chivalry died. The idea that horseback-mounted warriors, those who fought with swords, that's real chivalry, that's real combat. With guns, it takes it all away. So the idea exists across time. Well, one thing I'm curious, too, is how France and Paris change in the immediate aftermath of Nazi occupation. And what's interesting is that there's a lot of wrong ideas that affected the public consciousness about this. And a lot of it has to do with the Quentin Tarantino movie Inglourious Basterds. The movie begins with the line, "Once upon a time in Nazi-occupied France." And in Paris, you see these giant Nazi banners hanging from buildings. And now, when you're telling a movie where Hitler is assassinated, you have liberties to play with the historical record because it's not trying to be historically accurate. But I've heard from other World War II historians that there are people who think that's what Paris looked like when it was not the case at all. So we're already dealing with a lot of misconceptions. But what did Paris and what did France look like in the immediate aftermath of Nazi occupation?
Well, so remember that the people of Paris fled just before the Nazis occupied Paris. They, you know, like the modern day fall of Kabul, when it was clear that the city was about to be overtaken by the Nazis, everybody in the city, the only people left behind were the old and the infirm and the local police. People murdered their pets. They took all their belongings, put them in a car, they put them on a horse cart, and they fled the city by the millions. When the Germans arrived, they found not just an open city, they found an empty city. But rather, unlike Warsaw, which they leveled when they captured it, they decided to keep it as the showpiece of the new Nazi empire until they could transform Berlin, which they wanted to make an even better city than Paris. So at first, the Germans were very cordial to the French. They wanted to have an occupation where they treated the citizens with a benevolence that was almost ludicrous, to think that your city is being occupied by an oppressive conqueror and you're going to feel benevolence towards them. But soon, as the resistance rises up, as Nazi officers are shot down on the metro, all of a sudden the Nazis start kind of tightening that noose. The first thing that they do is they start public executions. They firing squads kill the members of the resistance or those who have violated the Nazi code of law. And then you get the rounding up of the Jews. Then all of a sudden there are food shortages, heating oil shortages, gasoline shortages. And you know, I really don't know how it works, but literally by the end of the war, taxi cabs in Paris were being run on charcoal briquettes. It was just that kind of thing. And actually by the end of the war, the people of Paris were eating the leaves off of trees just to get sustenance.
And this is a slight diversion from the main thrust of your book, but this is an argument that historians have come back to a lot about Paris and France during World War II, where in the immediate aftermath of the war, of course, there was a lot of celebration of the French underground, that France wanted to join the side of the victors and cast themselves as suffering under the Nazi regime. And they resisted as best they could under difficult circumstances. And any Nazi collaborators, whether it was women who slept with Nazis, they had their heads shaved, and those people were shamed. And members of the Vichy France government were imprisoned, but that shame was dealt with, and France was able to move on the right side of history in the 20th century. But other historians have argued that, well, that really wasn't quite the case. I mean, of course, there was a vigorous French underground, but there are others who were collaborating with the Nazis, and they were collaborating with occupiers, and some were trying to simply make the best of a terrible situation, and who knows how you or I would do in that situation. Others were openly doing it. So what's your take on this? It's a very complicated question, but because you've looked at it in depth, I'm curious how you see it.
Well, first of all, I like the fact that the resistance was completely organic. The people who chose to rise up and resist, there was no central organizer at first. They were not militarily trained. They had no weapons. You know, the whole city had been disarmed. And they didn't even know about each other. It wasn't like there was one group called the resistance. It was bunches of groups, but they began just doing little acts of sabotage. Maybe, you know, just passing along German troop movements to London or helping downed Allied flyers get out of occupied France. But the undercurrent of all of that was that there was always the chance that somebody that you didn't suspect, maybe your neighbor, maybe even your best friend, maybe your lover, was going to be a German collaborator or try to curry favor with the occupiers and give you away. I mean, so many people were betrayed by their best friend. It was just, it's crazy. And there's one instance that I talk about in the book where literally there was the Catholic priest who would literally hear confession. He would, and people would come in and say, you know, bless me, Father, I've sinned. I'm part of the resistance. I've done this to the Germans. And he would take that information and he would literally go to the Germans and say, that's supposed to be confidential knowledge. He would go to the Germans and say, this guy is part of the resistance. And then they'd round them all up. So after the war, like you said, the overt collaborators, the women who had their heads shaved, the police officials who collaborated, those were the easy targets. But in reality, there was always friction in occupied Paris about just not big time collaborators, but quiet, petty collaborators, people whose identities remained secret, just as secret as the members of the resistance as they gave people away.
Right. And I think it's easy to cast aspersion on people in that situation, but there were similar cases, let's say, in occupied nations as part of the East Asian co-prosperity sphere of Indochina and other places of that nature, that you had to deal with this thorny question of, if you're occupied, how do you go about your life? And what does collaboration mean? And if they people that you worked with closely are that they leave and they become the villains of history, what does that mean going forward? But without getting that kind of too far away from the narrative thrust of your book, as allies are thinking about the retaking of Paris, are there specific challenges that come with that where they, of course, want to retake the city, but having that be leveled, having that be destroyed in attack would be something much more, I don't know, heartrending than, let's say, Hamburg or a smaller second tier city?
Well, I mean, from a military point of view, retaking, liberating Paris was actually a very foolish act. It would have been much easier, literally, if Patton and the Third Army had just had not stopped to divert to Paris and had pushed all the way towards the German borders, we probably wouldn't have had a war that went on past Christmas of 1944. But when we stopped in Paris, we gave the Germans time to regroup, and this led to the Battle of the Bulge and the offensive of the Ardennes Forest. Because when you take a city, you don't just march into the city. Let's put it this way, a couple of things could have happened. So the U.S. could have gone into Paris. The Germans could have remained in the city. It could have become street fighting. They could have used their big guns against our big guns. Could have had tanks in the streets. And we could have reduced the city to rubble and then, you know, fought the Germans mile by mile just to get them out of the city. And the other thing, too, is when you go into a city, you have to feed the people. You have a moral obligation to take care of them. You have to give them heating oil. You have to make sure that they have proper medical supplies. So when you have the whole U.S. Army pivoting towards Paris just to liberate a city that is actually going to become a detriment to your war effort, you have to wonder why Eisenhower chose to do it. And I can only say that it was purely out of romantic purposes. I know you can make an argument that he did it because there was a communist uprising or the city was about to have a big rebellion against the Germans and then get slaughtered. But, you know, both Eisenhower and Patton had lived in Paris earlier in their careers. Both were fluent French speakers. And there's something about what Paris symbolized at that time. When it fell, it was the city of enlightenment, which has fallen into darkness as the Nazis take it. And when as people pulled closer to Paris, the idea of liberating the city was of huge symbolic importance, not just in Europe, but around the world, because a free Paris, it is the taking off of the Nazi mantle of authority. And once again, you know, revealing the great liberties that the world had enjoyed in Paris before. So when Eisenhower makes that bold military decision to take Paris, it is not done lightly. But I like I said, I think it is one of the few times in military history that somebody did something romantic instead of pragmatic in military thinking.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know that hard times create hard men create good times create soft men create hard times. That's how the cycle of history works, right? Well, as guest Dan Carlin explains, that's not exactly the case.
You had mentioned, you know, what we had talked about with Kennedy being elected because, you know, who did better at the debate or who's going to lower my taxes or all these banal things 2 years before 100 million plus people are killed in a thermonuclear war, right? Did you elect the right guy then?
To listen to more of this History Unplugged interview with Dan Carlin about why the end is always near, search for History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUGGED to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUGGED to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUGGED to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUGGED to 30605.
That goes against, like, for example, from a purely strategic standpoint, even during World War II, you have the island hopping campaign in the Pacific, where you're simply skipping over enemy supply lines. And if you cut them off further down, that's going to cause other fruit on the vine to wither. Or Napoleonic tactics, where you don't just do the ink blot, but you hop over and do things. But they're having a different approach. And this isn't just Eisenhower, this is others too. So there's a scene in your book where Charles de Gaulle is trying to convince Eisenhower of the very same. So can you describe that scene and what's de Gaulle's thought process with this?
Well, de Gaulle, who I'm convinced was a little bit crazy, he believes he's a man of destiny. He believes he is a modern day Joan of Arc who's come to rescue the people of France, and that he alone is the defender of France. And in many ways, this is true. You know, he fled when the French government fell to the Germans. He fled to England and set up a government in exile. But he had no money. He had no guns. He had no army. And somehow he managed to convince the French people that he had a moral authority. So what he does is he flies to France from England, lands at MacArthur's headquarters, and then convinces, it's a rainy day. De Gaulle is this tall, overbearing, 6'3" guy. Eisenhower is much more cordial. But Eisenhower is actually afraid that he's going to be intimidated by de Gaulle. But at the same time, all of the French divisions that have remained in the war are fighting for the Allies. So he's not going to detach those to let de Gaulle take Paris on his own. So de Gaulle is not one to plead. He's not one to beg. But at the same time, he is one to try to impose his will on others. And Eisenhower stands up to him and says, no, we're not going to go into Paris. And de Gaulle says, well, I'm going to go get the French 4th Armored and we're going to go into Paris. And Eisenhower's like, no, you're not. They're not going to do anything because I've got the tanks, I've got the gas, I've got the manpower. But within a matter of hours, he changes his mind. He decides it is the best thing to do it. And by this time, de Gaulle has gone and he makes the decision, which I think is a very bold decision. And you know, he works with Patton and they liberate the city.
You could argue that a lot of these leaders in World War II, they retain their mental sharpness, but they are a little crazy, like Patton, who thought that he would go to Valhalla after he died. So he's in good company that way. Well, you mentioned something very interesting there, that this is military planning on purely romantic grounds. And there's a J.R.R. Tolkien quote I like where he says, I do not love the bright sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I love only that which they defend. And so this kind of gets into a big question. I suppose some could argue that what is the purpose of fighting a warfare to not just simply to defeat an enemy, unless you're really, I mean, that sounds like an Apocalypse Now type of thing. I love the smell of napalm in the morning, war for the sake of warfare. Others would say, well, we do that to preserve our civilization, not nearly to win. And I'm thinking of other anecdotes in history of romantic gestures in warfare, like the First Crusade, where the Crusaders march around the cities of Jerusalem 7 times to mimic the Old Testament Exodus out of Egypt and marching around the walls of Jericho. But then there's also crazy people who do romantic things. And an analogy isn't springing to mind. I'm sure you can think of some. I'm sure Saddam Hussein did bizarre things like comparing himself to Nebuchadnezzar. How do you see that kind of like there's something to that of protecting the elements of civilization, even if it does not meet a strategic aim? So what do you see as like the good and the bad of that in the wider aims of World War II?
Well, I think one of the reasons we tend to, and I'm guilty of this too, tend to glorify World War II a little bit, and it's why there's been so many books and movies about it, is because it's the last war of good against evil in our lifetimes or in our recent history. But it was a very real thing. You know, Hitler was evil. Nazi Germany was evil. And the U.S. and the Allies, we were the good guys. And liberating Paris was, again, it was very, very symbolic. It was a symbolic gesture that, hey, D-Day is one thing, but D-Day was kind of messy and it took a while to push all the way inland to Paris. But by liberating Paris, it was this reminder, the symbolic reminder that good was triumphing over evil. As coincidentally, I read an old Time magazine article from the week after the liberation of Paris, and that was exactly how they described it, how the world was rejoicing because good was triumphing over evil. And even though I had written this book about the liberation of Paris, it didn't dawn on me until I read that article that that was how not just the U.S., not just Europe saw it, but the entire world saw the liberation of Paris as the triumph of good over evil, which I think is fascinating. You don't think about that of many military decisions.
That's very true. I mean, and that's what makes World War II unique in many ways. Can you describe the liberation of Paris in itself? What was the plan? Because this is, in many ways, a rescue mission where if you're going to storm in, you can't just go guns blazing. You have to safely remove the target. Very different from, say, an assassination mission where if there's collateral damage, then that's not as much of a concern. So what was the planning and the execution of the retaking of Paris?
First off, the Germans were prepared to destroy the city. All the bridges over the Seine were wired with bombs to explode. All the city's power plants were wired to explode. So the Germans were ready to destroy the city. And Hitler reportedly kept calling General von Choltitz, who was the commander of forces in Paris, he kept calling and saying, "Is Paris burning?" He wanted to know that Paris was going to be burned to the ground before the Germans pulled out. Two groups came in. One was American armor, one was French armor. And they made the long journey from the coast in a relatively short period of time, and they approached the city from the south. And as they came, the French got in first, and the people of Paris knew they were coming. They knew that the French were coming, and they knew the Americans were coming. So that emboldened them. They began rising up against the Germans, which was not really smart because the Germans were still the Germans. You know, they still fired their guns. They weren't running away quite yet. So the French finally get in and followed closely thereafter by the Americans. And the scenes of euphoria, we've all seen the newsreel photos of people dancing in the streets and throwing flowers at the tanks and bottles of wine and soldiers kissing local girls and all that kind of stuff. But the thing that really stayed with me was, and it's kind of a crazy thing to imagine, as the French divisions approached Paris, they realized that they were close enough to home that they could just call their parents. And a lot of them got out of their tank, they found a public phone, and they called home and said, "Mom and Dad, I'm coming home." And sadly, a lot of them made that call and then actually died before they got into Paris because there was very pitched fighting outside the city. But then you have some people who did get into the city, got out of their tank, walked through the front door of their childhood home and greeted their parents and seen them in 4 years. Amazing moment.
How did the battle unfold so that major sites of the city and bridges and et cetera weren't destroyed?
First of all, the Germans began to evacuate. As it became clear that the Americans and the French were coming for them, they evacuated. They pulled out. They began leaving the city. A few isolated snipers remained. For the most part, the Germans left. But von Choltitz, and I don't know why he did this, because he had overseen the destruction of Rotterdam in 1940, where the city was effectively leveled. I mean, just done. And then the same thing with Sevastopol later in the war, after fighting with the Russians. But for some reason, I think he just didn't want to be the man who would go down in history as the guy who destroyed Paris. And so rather than blow the bridges, rather than blow the power plants, rather than destroying the aqueducts, he just orders the German troops out and he begins discussions with the French, even as they're coming into the city, about how best to transfer power over to the French and surrender the German forces. Again, there's a little bit of romance to this, and you don't think of warfare and military decision-making as being romantic, but there's something about Paris that captivated people on both sides of the coin.
Do you know of any writings of his where he perceived himself in this historical moment that, okay, I don't want to be the Umayyad general who burns the Library of Alexandria. I don't want to be Alaric or a different Germanic barbarian who sacks Paris. Are you aware that he has any sense of this?
You know, there aren't like journal recordings and stuff like that. And remember, too, if he was found to be in direct disobedience to an order from Hitler, which he was by surrendering the city, he had to make it appear that he had no choice in the matter, because otherwise they would have killed his entire family. That's how they exerted power over a general in the field from far away. So he had to be very, very careful about that. And later, when he was in Allied custody and he was secretly recorded, he kind of let on that he made himself more of a legend than he was. But later in life, he became friends with a lot of the French who had come in to liberate the city and attended some of their funerals. I mean, it's a strange relationship came out of that moment in history.
Well, like you said, we have newsreel footage of the euphoria that happens in Paris, probably the most in the entire war, even more so than when you see scenes of New York, of the famous picture of the sailor kissing the woman in Times Square. So what was it like in the immediate aftermath when Paris is retaken? There's a euphoria. And then what's it like as allies retake it and exert control?
Well, first of all, the euphoria is amazing. You know, they're tearing down the swastikas. They're flying the Arc de Triomphe, the tricolor over the Arc de Triomphe again. And it's just nonstop revelry. It's just the people had bottles of wine and champagne that they had hidden away from the Germans just for that day. They opened them up. People were in the streets singing La Marseillaise. It was about a 4 or 5 days of a big national bender, let's put it that way. And the U.S. Army, in a show of force, marched down the Champs-Élysées on August 29th. 24 men abreast, is, you know, American troops as far as the eye could see. They had marched in the previous day from Versailles. And it was just a show of strength by the U.S. military, like, this is us, this is what we've done, we're here, we protected you. And it was the same thing. People, you know, women were running out to kiss the soldiers and giving them a bottle of champagne and roses. But those same guys, those same men marching 24 abreast, those columns of men literally walked from one side of Paris to the other and then just kept marching. They went right back into combat. And within 20 miles, four of the men who had been in the front row of that very front row of that thing were dead after this moment of euphoria. But then it just begins the occupation. It just where things have to go back to normal. And people had to be administered food coupons. And the U.S. began the regular shuttling of supplies all the way from the coast by truck because the trains were destroyed. And this huge convoys of trucks bringing food into the city and distributing food. And De Gaulle takes charge of France as the new leader. We think of him as the longtime leader of France, but at that time, he just remained in power for about a year before stepping down. And he was trying to form a coalition with the communists where he was in charge. So it was the French taking back their city, at the same time still reliant on the U.S. to take care of them.
Well, for this chapter in history, as you noted, it's a very unique chapter. It's hard to compare to a lot of other things, but as you were pondering it, I'm sure there's a lot of other lessons that could be applied elsewhere. And I'm just thinking of the different cities I've lived in, for example, in Istanbul. Sadly, a lot of the city was destroyed, but there are monuments, and its most famous buildings were passed from power to power to power, such as the Hagia Sophia that went under Christian. It was built by Orthodox Christians under Islamic control, still to this day, by a religious government, then a secular government, and then a secular government that's becoming growingly religious, but that part of civilization wasn't destroyed. So that's one factor, but what do you hope are some of the main takeaways that readers will get from your book?
Well, the number one thing is I wanted to tell a big story, you know, and we do that from May 10th through 1940 through the end of August 1944. But I also didn't want it to be one of those history books where you had to labor to read it. I want to tell this epic cinematic story in a fast-paced way that brings the reader in. It makes you want to turn the pages. It makes you really excited about history. I mean, I've got a passion for history, as I'm sure you do. And it pains me when people tell me the history is boring, because history is not boring. It's just written in a boring fashion. So what I try to do with this book is, and one takeaway, I want people to read this book. I want to zip through the pages and get down and go, man, that was a great story. And know that it wasn't a piece of fiction. It was completely true. And some of the greatest works of history are far more exciting than any fiction novel. But I also want to take away the fact that it's about the big players, you know, the Churchills and the Pattons and the Eisenhowers. But it's also about the Jean Moulins and the Virginia Halls and the members of the resistance, Germaine Tillion, all these lesser players that we don't really know about, but whose daily actions and whose decisions formed the shape of the war as much as anything that Churchill or Roosevelt did.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of different players here, but also I think a new way to look at an episode that I think a lot of people know well, which I always like to do on the show. Well, for listeners who want to dig in more, the name of the book is Taking Paris, the Epic Battle for the City of Lights. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.